Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 791. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. This is real events happening in the world from Nerdist folks like you. Aldrin Cornejo, who is a fantastic supporter of all things comedy. He comes to a ton of shows. Totally good dude. He says his friend and regular Nerdist showroom attendee, Doug Culp, and he run a house called Duplex Comedy Suplex. This is every Thursday night. They do it out of their duplex in Little Armenia in Los Angeles. It's an intimate space with a very positive vibe. We've hosted many of our favorite comics, including Kyle Clark. Each week, he creates a flyer for the next week's show by doing what he calls hashtag sketched improv. He asks the audience for three suggestions. They combine them all into an image that he presents at the end of the show. For more information, go to facebook.com/duplexcomedysuplex. Do you see? This is why you can do the thing that you want to do. These guys are comedy fans. They started a show. You might go, well, I can't really have access to a theater. They started a show in their fucking apartment. You have no excuses. And well done, Aldrin and Doug, for that. facebook.com/duplexcomedysuplex. Dave Furtick writes, I'm one of the producers of a show in Greenpoint, Brooklyn called Puppet Playlists. The show takes brilliant puppeteers and talented musicians and slams it together into an evening of live theater to stir the senses. The theme for their 20th show is going to be Billy Joel. So you have a choice. You can go see the actual Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden, or you come to Brooklyn and see some ridiculously talented puppeteers and musicians create all new interpretations of Billy Joel's music as part of Puppet Playlist number 20. This features original works of puppetry inspired by some of the songs of Billy Joel, mixed with live musical interpretations by some of New York's awesome singer-songwriters. Performances are March 17th and 18th. Tickets are only $15, can be purchased at puppetplaylist.com or at the door. This episode is Mr. J.J. Abrams and Dan Trachtenberg. Dan, you might know from Totally Rad Show. He also directed an amazing short about 5 years ago called Portal No Escape, and he's directed 10 Cloverfield Lane. Now, I saw 10 Cloverfield Lane the other night. I had no idea what to expect, and it is fucking fantastic. I know you would expect me to say that because they're on the show. I know I'm very positive about everything, but I'm telling you, this movie is great. The performances in it are fantastic. I mean, John Goodman is... everyone's phenomenal. Mary Elizabeth Winstead. It's such a good movie. You don't have to have seen the original Cloverfield, which is also really good, but I got motion sick watching. This is not a shaky cam found footage movie. It's a separate... it's its own thing. I don't want to... if I explain it too much, I'll give it away, but you just need to see it. It is great, and I am positive this is going to launch Dan's career as a very influential director, because the movie's fantastic. And we got to sit down with JJ too. We went to Bad Robot and got to hang out, look at all their props and do this. And every night I go to bed and I go, how is my life this way? How do I get to do these amazing things? So I think you will enjoy this episode. And then JJ gives away some... he just kind of offhandedly says something near the end of the podcast that Dan and I are like, what? What did you just say? That I don't think we knew or anyone else. So listen for that at the end. You'll know it when you hear it. 10 Cloverfield Lane is in theaters as of now, March 11th. So don't waste any time. Go see 10 Cloverfield Lane. I promise you will not regret it. All right, here's Nerdist Podcast number 791 with JJ Abrams and Dan Trachtenberg.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hey man,
how's it going?
Wow, nice to meet you. Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
We're trying to play all the keyboards.
But is it already sequences. Recording? I bet. Right.
I just started.
Okay. Now it is.
Because usually we hear the door close, the guests are already talking. Makes it all feel very authentic.
Yeah. Well, we were just having a conversation. That's all it is.
Maybe I'll just go grab my jacket. Sorry, keep it.
Sure.
Keep it like this. I'll go grab my jacket. I'll be back. How's you work?
How's everybody?
Good.
Are you Katie?
No, that's Katie.
Oh, you're Katie? Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan, Chris.
What?
Yeah.
You shut your goddamn mouth. I loved we'll get into all this, but, you know, we have so many Rev 3 friends in common.
Yeah, yeah. No, we've actually met in passing a couple times through Alex at Comic-Con once, and then
possibly through Ryan Vance as well.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Vance. Wow, I haven't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah, Ryan was at G4, and then he went over to work at Rev 3.
Right, right.
And weirdly just had an office at G4 for years that just had his name on it that was like, he doesn't work here anymore.
Oh, that's funny.
But, yeah, Ryan, had, you know, it was a good group. We were talking about, we could probably talk about Rev 3 a little bit, right?
Yeah, totally. Hold on, let me
grab it. Just saying that the interesting thing about Rev 3 was that, number one, very much ahead of the curve.
Yes.
Years ahead of the curve.
Way too ahead. Too ahead.
Too
yeah. To their fault, probably.
a little too ahead. But right. Also, you know, the idea of Rev 3 being essentially an entertainment channel, but Silicon Valley minded versus entertainment
right.
minded, which in one sense is interesting because it's like, oh, they're shaking it up. But the other side is like, oh, I don't think they understand some of the compromises that kind of need to,
totally.
You know, because they have their startup mentality. So
totally.
We
don't totally.
Have to fucking do what you say.
It's so crazy because when we first were thinking about doing the Totally Rad Show, when we were like putting together what the pitch for it was, there was also a company called Juice or something that was internet video before anyone else. And we were like, we might be able to do video for this show because podcasts didn't have video components. And thank God we didn't – because that could have been the thing that took off as much as Revision 3 did. But then we held
what up. What codec should we use?
Yeah.
And what format should we post to?
Totally.
So there are some pages that can just autoplay a QuickTime file. And I think that would be really amazing if we could figure that out.
What's crazy, too, is thinking back before YouTube, there was like remember iFilm?
Yeah, of course.
And you
had
to watch
iFilm.
Something on RealPlayer.
Yes.
And there was a short film. Called 405. Do you remember that? It was
no.
The first of they that team that did that got like a 3-picture deal off of the short film. That was they erased all the cars in the 405 and they had a plane landing and it was all about a plane landing on the 405.
That sounds familiar,
yeah,
but I don't know if I
would find it impossible if you hadn't actually seen it. It was
who bought iFilm? Someone bought iFilm. Was it someone had? Someone bought – because iFilm was really the repository for all of that for the
right.
longest time.
Right.
And even though YouTube's only 11 years old, it feels like what did we do
right.
before – I mean like
right.
just seeing how long the Rooster Teeth guys have been doing. It's like what did you do before?
Right.
Like, well, we had to post little videos, tiny little thumbnail size videos that
totally.
Took forever.
That looked horrible. I still remember, too, like in Car, my cousin got Encarta Cyclopedia
yeah.
on CD-ROM and then played videos. And there, you could watch a clip of videos that were so pixelated. And but I loved that.
Oh, I remember watching the Encarta CD-ROM videos and my – what was it? I think at that time it was a Macintosh Performa computer, which I had to buy from Mac Mall because there was no Apple Store.
And crazy.
There was PC Mall, and then Mac Mall was the Mac alternative.
But not Babbage's Electronics? You couldn't get
– I knew Babbage's, yes.
Yes, Babbage's.
But Mac Mall – PC Mall had – I feel like PC Mall had a store that I could go to that had – a small Mac section.
Yes, yes.
It was right around the time that. Thank you. Welcome. It was right around the time of the old Mac ads with Jeff Goldblum. You know,
I don't remember that.
You
Jeff Goldblum's Mac ads?
Yeah, yeah. Not only did Jeff Goldblum did these Mac ads, and then someone a few years ago slowed them down by about 30%, and it made him sound super drunk just because of the way he was talking.
I do not remember that. My first computer was a Mac SE, though.
Really?
Yeah, black and white. I was so jealous of my friend's color PCs.
God damn it. My first computer was a TRS-80, a Tandy
yeah.
/ Radio Shack TRS-80.
Wow.
Which was a terminal computer, so it was a terminal, so the keyboard was built into the and it didn't really do much.
Right.
Not until the advancements of the TRS-80 Color Computer 2. That you could run through your television, your RCA.
Oh, wow.
So that was really – that's when technology really
I'm sure
took
you
off.
Remember. I'm sure you must have had this too, but growing
oh
up
– oh, my God. J.J. Abrams, like, where did you come from?
What?
But remember in class learning computers, there was a thing called Turtle that you had to type in code and you gave it directions and it would go.
Oh my God.
That was how we learned. That was learning computers in kindergarten. I think we had that in my school.
Yeah. You know, in kindergarten, we did not have.
Yeah, maybe.
When I was in kindergarten, turtling was you poop your pants a little bit. So it was a
different. Oh, I had that too, actually. That's multi-generational.
By the way, we have not been ignoring JJ the whole time. He just came in and sat down. we were talking about early video. We were talking about Revision 3, where he used to work, and just about being ahead of the curve in video and how it seems only in a decade how anything ever got posted before that, just because.
Do you remember 405? That short film that was the plane landing.
Yeah. The old lady in the car?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I actually referenced that in this TED Talk that I did years ago.
Oh, crazy. Oh, what? The Mystery Box TED Talk?
Yeah.
What do you know? Look at that. See, you did know of it for sure.
Well, I was a fan of yours from, not just because of Totally Rad Show, but also Portal No Escape is so fucking good, which is like 5 years old now.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
That's great. I remember hearing you talk about it with Aisha Tyler, maybe even on her podcast, and I flipped out.
Oh, yeah. We did talk about it on her podcast.
That was so amazing. That was a long time ago. But that was really fun to make. I started out doing commercials and also hosting the Totally Rad Show, but always wanted to make movies, and all the commercials that I did were very like slice of life, emotional, documentary style, not big and cinematic and ultimately like the kind of movie that I wanted to make. So I decided to do this short based on that because, I was seeing a lot of success happening from these shorts that were very effects focused and felt more like effects reels than stories. And I thought this would be a cool opportunity to do something that's very story oriented and that also has special effects, but they're not, you know, giant robots and aliens, which is stuff that I love, but the effect itself is something that's sort of interesting. And so on the one hand, it can be something that's very visceral, but it's also something that engages you in a very puzzling way. And I also love like Michel Gondry and Spike Jonze, and I thought it'd be cool to have a visual effect that's sort of mind-bendy as opposed to
which is perfect for Portal. And at that particular time, like watching filmmakers use YouTube – and like, oh, you can actually make something look really good inexpensively and showcase that, you know, this is a real platform for legitimate narrative content.
Totally. Yeah.
I have to apologize to you, JJ Abrams, because
say no more.
All right. What am I supposed to do with this baby?
Nobody apologized for.
Okay, well now let's probably explore that. We were at a snazzy party after the Academy Awards, and
oh my gosh,
I met Tim Cook, and I froze because I was talking to someone from Apple, and I go, oh, Tim Cook's over there. Have you met him? No. Tim, come here. I'm like, no, I wasn't prepared.
Oh god.
And then I didn't know what to say. I meant to thank him for protecting our privacy.
Right.
Couldn't get that out. It was just like, I saw you at an airport. Like, it was just the... So I turn and grab the person next to me to go, holy shit, I just met Tim Cook, and it's you.
Yeah.
And so then I was embarrassed for a couple of reasons, because number one, you're like, no, we're, you know, you and Tim are friends naturally. And I just felt like a complete douchebag.
No, it was very it was sweet that you had that reaction about him. I was, because you know it's incredible what they do over there, and it's deserved. Mm-hmm. But you know he's such a good guy, and you know I totally understood that crazy excitement. But it's funny. There's this crazy thing that just happened to come up in this. An episode of the show we're doing where he was actually he was written in as like a cameo and he'll never do it, but I was basically trying to sell him on.
You don't know if he won't do. He might do it.
Would that be fun?
That would be amazing. But it's funny how no matter where you are in your career, and it's like I feel like I'm doing a million things, but then I look at you and I go, no, JJ's really doing a million things. But then you probably look at Tim Cook and go, no, Tim Cook's really doing a million things.
We're all, you know, doing a million things. But the things that, like, what they do, it's incredible when you think about the tools that we use that have come from that place. And now you see that giant building that they're building. You've seen the videos of this, you know. Right?
I've seen like some of the concept.
Wait, I haven't seen.
It's insane.
It's a new compound.
It is this giant. It's a huge ring. It's like this massive, you know, donut shaped. But it's just it's insanely big. It's you know, and you just think, what are they going to do there?
Like, well, it's
what
clearly is it, a particle accelerator that's going to open some like. Sort of a window into another
right.
universe.
It's incredible. Right. I'm just so
yeah. There it is, Dan. Yeah. Look,
oh my gosh!
I'm so in awe of
awesome.
Of
you know,
what,
from space,
it looks really
though,
fake though. To me,
I have to say, from space, it'll kind of look like the Earth's butthole. I mean, not to. It's amazing up close, but I think from far away, it does.
That's
it does.
Funny.
It does look like a butt. Just a little bit though. Just a little bit.
Just the inner ring.
Just yeah.
not really the whole. Yeah.
I wonder if I say that and someone hears it, and they go, "God damn it!" And they just.
Like cancel the plans,
or they just yeah. cut it in half or something, just so it doesn't look exactly right. like a thing.
Yeah.
How do you keep your brain together? How do you keep, you know, especially because when I heard the announcement for 10 Cloverfield Lane, feels like it came out pretty quickly, and now the movie's coming out, and I think I just felt like, but you just got through the space movie, so how do you how are you able to packet switch and get into the production of this?
Well, we were. Working on this for a long time, and Lindsay Weber, who runs Features here, has and produced the movie with me, was running point on it, and I was involved early on. I was less involved, just sort of watching dailies and throwing out suggestions during the shoot. But it was, you know, Dan, you know, had it under control, and Lindsay was doing great, and she was there on set as well, and in New Orleans. And then when we finished up with Force Awakens, I got to be a little bit more involved, and again, would just offer opinions. But you know, it's Dan's movie, and it was a really fun kind of, in a way, an antidote in a way to the sort of massive responsibility of Star Wars to get involved in something that was fun to work on with people who are terrific to work with. That was a much more intimate movie that. We actually, you know, that no one had expectations for. And so it was literally the opposite experience. And it was up to us to try and get attention. This movie deserves it, I think. I think Dan did an amazing job. And we were hoping that people would, and we'll see what happens, but hopefully people will react well to the film itself. But I think Dan did an extraordinary job. And for me, it was just a blast to work on.
I mean, I saw it. So Tuesday... I got an email from Paramount that said, you know, we really need you to see the movie before you do the thing. And I go, I don't, you know, I'm moving and I'm editing my comedy special in addition to At Midnight and Talking Dead and Nerdist and Podcast. Like, I can't create time.
You're doing more than Tim Cook.
I'm doing a lot more than Tim. I just want it to be known that I'm doing more than Tim. And I was like, I don't know if I can do this. And I said, you know, we won't really be able to talk a lot about the movie anyway because we can't spoil anything. And they said, if there's any way you can see it, just try. So I call my fiance, who is my ultimate – who I have the most responsibility to. And I said, I know we were supposed to do moving stuff tonight, but they're going to – Paramount's offered to screen 10 Cloverfield Lane. And we watch every horror, sci-fi, everything together. And I said, you know, do you want to just kind of make this a date night? And she was like, yeah, let's do it. So then it became this really fun date night. They set up this private screening room for us at Paramount. And the movie was fucking fantastic. It was so good, Dan.
Awesome.
It was so good.
Awesome.
It was unexpected, and it didn't. She.
What did your fiance think?
She loved it.
Okay.
You know, my first question when they said, "Will you screen the movie?" was like, "Is it shaky cam found footage?" Because I almost threw up. I loved the first Cloverfield, but there were a couple times where I thought I was going to throw up and pass out.
Yeah, me too.
And I had to. I was just listening to most of it.
I didn't have that reaction to Cloverfield, but Blair Witch Project, I saw opening night at the Angelica in New York, and I walked out and puked my guts out, literally. Yeah, left the theater and threw up everywhere.
I get motion sick, and I didn't at all in Blair Witch. And on Cloverfield, I remember saying to Matt, you know, I will throw up when I watch this movie. Can you please? And I never did because we were watching it on the Avid, so you're looking at a small screen.
Right, right.
And then I remember at the premiere, I watched and I saw my dad literally leave the theater.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, I'm going to be right behind him because I was like, you know, it's really hard. And yet, it's true to that style.
Yeah, absolutely.
But dear
absolutely.
Lord.
Yeah. It's sometimes it gets you, sometimes it doesn't. I remember playing Wolfenstein as a kid. And if you're not controlling it, I think like sometimes you're in sync with the filmmaking and the camera is doing, because even watching a Paul Greengrass movie or something, you
I'll still get sick playing Halo now.
Yeah, yeah, no, 100%.
It's
but
crazy.
You have to. It's like if you ever like jerk the controller in a way that you didn't intend, that's what I think creates that feeling. But if you're in sync with where the camera's going and what's happening, then I feel like it doesn't do that weird inner ear brain.
I don't know.
Thing.
Blair Witch, I saw the way that the best way to have seen Blair Witch
given
was
to you on tape.
Someone gave me an unmarked VHS tape, and
amazing.
They're like, and this was at that time in 97, I think it was. This was before 98. This was before the whole like, oh, it's found footage,
right.
You know. So there were titterings of like, is this real? What is this? You know.
Yeah.
And it was like around the same time people were passing around videotapes of Spirit of Christmas, you know, before South Park.
Oh, the South Park thing. Yeah,
so
totally.
It was IRL viral of actually having to create and hand out tapes, and it didn't make me sick because of that reason. But yeah, I you know, I actually haven't even been on the new Star Tours because the old Star Tours at Disneyland. Mm. Made me so ill that I was afraid to go on the new one.
I've been sick on Star Tours, but the new Star Tours is awesome. You have to. In fact, I haven't been on it since. Is there Force Awakens stuff?
There is. In fact, we filmed it here.
Oh my gosh.
John Boyega in
the
new Star Tours ride was filmed right here.
But does it randomly show up like all the other things, or do you definitely have that and
no,
then
I
you
think
get
it's,
a random?
I think it has that kind of randomization thing where every ride's different because there are a number of different options.
Yeah. It's awesome, dude. I think it being 3D is sort of helpful because you're more immersed.
You're a little more immersed. But with your movie, though.
Yeah. No nausea inducing.
Yeah. And what's great about it is because when I tweeted out, this movie's amazing and people need to see it, which is honestly how I felt. I really think people should see it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because it's unexpected and it's not – you don't have to have seen the first one. I think it's nice if you've seen the first one, but – it also sets up this kind of Cloverfield this universe that's sort of loosely, almost Black Mirror style. Did you see Black Mirror at all?
Love.
So, you know.
First season. I never saw the,
Everything's a part of this. It feels like everything's a part of this universe without necessarily being a direct, this leads to this kind of thing.
No, it's like you can watch any Twilight Zone in any order.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, of course. Mm-hmm. You have the Twilight Zone plates upstairs here, right? You still have
the plates?
Don't you have the credit plates?
Oh, we only have the at the very end for Serling's production company. It's sort of the seal of approval, like the kind of the good housekeeping seal of approval type thing at the end.
But it's the original, right?
The original.
Yeah.
Was
so just that. You just have that. You just have that piece of television history upstairs on the wall.
The greatest thing I just found, I was going through some old files and stuff and just trying to get rid of things that I don't need. And I found this letter that I had forgotten about. There's a letter from Rod Serling to a fan. And it was this letter that said basically, you know, someone had written and asked some questions. And it was Serling saying, you know, I don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to just give you some quick answers. And it was an 8-page typed single-space response to so many questions about how he writes, what his process is, how he comes up with ideas, why he did a certain thing in a movie. You know, it was talking about Planet of the Apes. It was after that. It was the most generous letter from someone who claimed not to, you know, had a lot of time to respond, but it was just, it really spoke to this, you know, his
Reddit would have killed Rod Serling. He never would have done anything
else.
Not,
yeah, he Twitter would not have worked for him. But it was an incredible thing to see, just to make this Rod Serling discovery. So.
What were some of the things that he said in terms of his?
I can show you the letter. It's really, it's very cool.
Can I just have it?
Or sure. Is that, yeah,
okay,
sure.
Great. Thanks.
We'll do that.
What?
I threw it away. I didn't need it.
I got it. I can't let anyone else see this.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a different time. And Rod Serling seemed like kind of an intense guy. He seemed like a little bit of an intense guy.
Yeah, and I've gotten to know Carol, his widow, who is one of the greatest and sweetest people of all time. And it's just an amazing thing. I was talking to her once about his process, which was he would dictate his scripts. Mm. So I asked her, does she have any tapes? And she said, oh, yes. And so she gave me this piece of audio that is him doing a script. This was post-Twilight Zone. But to hear him write. And this was years and years ago. I listened to it for the first time in my office at home. And it was like 1:30 in the morning. And I put it on. And I was just alone in the middle of the night with, you know, listening to Rod Serling writing. And it was so... it was so beautiful and so creepy, and it, like, you'd hear where he'd turn off the microphone because he was just thinking, and then he'd turn it back on again.
Oh my God.
And it was just amazing. And it was his process. And you heard him coming up with it. And then he'd revise the line he just did. And he'd give the tape. It was on a dictaphone. And he would give the tape to his assistant, who would then type it all up. But it was an amazing thing. And she is a wonderful, wonderful person, Carol.
Was there hemming and hawing? Like, did you see him fumbling for words at all? Or was he always
What he would do is he would make specific corrections about things that he would say. Like, he would make sure it was, like, so it was, like, formatted in the right way. Mm-hmm. But what was cool was where he would pause it, because he would kind of go on a run of a couple lines of dialogue, then you hear, like, and you just know he, like, stopped and thought and considered, then he kept going. And it was just this, you know, it was an incredible insight into a hero.
Mm. Well, speaking of that, when the last time we were here, I think it was probably like 4 or 5 years ago, maybe, talking to you about, we were talking about 8mm a lot. And
Format. Super 8? Format 8mm.
Super 8, not 8mm. That's the 8mm was the Nick Cage movie.
Joel,
I know, you're always obsessed. Joel Schumacher. Yeah, you're always obsessed with that movie. Yeah. You always come here talking about that movie.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a very creepy movie.
It's totally creepy. Know,
there was a scene at the end of it.
Sort of a ripoff of, what did it come right after? I guess 7, sort of, right? People thought it
came
was.
Came up, yeah.
It was in that kind of snuff film.
Yes, right.
Category.
But there was, I remember, oh boy.
Joel Schumacher, I think, is a really, I mean, not recently, but he's awesome. He made so many different cool movies.
Oh, Flatliners.
Yeah, Flatliners is cool.
Flatliners is great.
But Lost Boys, amazing. But then some, like, and then Tigerland. I remember loving Tigerland when it came out.
Which is
totally different. And like, always really cool, different genres.
Yeah.
Love that, from that era. Yeah.
I remember watching Lost Boys and somehow
really wanting to play the saxophone.
That's the thing. Somehow being okay with, like, sure, all the cool kids would go down and listen to a shirtless muscle man play the saxophone. Why wouldn't they do that? It's the 80s. But there's a scene at the end of 8mm where Nick Cage is like, he's been through it. He's had it. He can't take it anymore. And he just starts crying. He starts doing this, like, and the theater I was in erupted with laughter. I'm like, I don't think this was the intended.
Yeah. Did you see Animal's Fire?
Joel Schumacher did. Right, exactly. Amazing. I think it may be one of his first movies.
Come on.
Yeah.
And by the way, who wrote Car Wash? Joel Schumacher.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Who wrote Taking Care of Business?
Mic drop.
J.J. Abrams?
Right.
Yeah. And we're back.
But also, who wrote the line, time to chill?
Who wrote that line?
Oh. It's probably Joel Schumacher.
Oh, okay.
Kiva Goldsman?
Yeah.
But
I love...
Get the gems, kill the heroes. I'm just quoting from the movie.
Amazing.
But when we were here, we were talking about Super 8, and, you know, you were... Really, it was kind of a period of major transition for you, it felt like. And you said, oh, and we went in there and Spielberg came in and he helped me fix this one thing. So, but you're kind of that now. Like, you're that guy to
Dan. To me, 100%. So 1,000,000%. Yeah.
I know you might not think that.
That's ridiculous.
No, it's not. You fucking just directed a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of weird postpartum after doing something of that scale where you, probably your whole life, you go, wow, that would be the ultimate. And then you do it, and it goes well. So what do you feel afterwards?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's a funny thing, and you just brought up Taking Care of Business. I remember my whole life, since I was 8 or 9, wanting to be a filmmaker. And it was just this thing that I just knew, if I was lucky enough to get the shot, would be how I'd want to live my life. Whether I could or not, you know, I didn't know. But it was the thing I wanted forever. And there's that thing that happened for me, and I'm sure we all have our versions of this, that you kind of think, okay, that's somehow the finish line. That's the place you want to get to. And when you get there, you will have become that person, that thing. You will reach a certain level of insight or evolution or whatever that you will feel like I have become that person. And I remember when I was in my last year of college and I ran into a friend, Joel Mazursky, and we came up with an idea and we ended up writing it and then selling this pitch to Disney, and it was Taking Care of Business. And I remember signing these documents and getting paid, and I was suddenly a professional screenwriter. And I remember the feeling of not feeling different and how weird that was. And then I remember when the movie actually got made, I thought, okay, I'll see my name on... That was what it was, seeing my name on, and at the time, Jeffrey Abrams was, you know, which is my given name, my full name. I thought, well, I'll go with that. That sounds much more grown up. And I saw Jeffrey Abrams on the screen, I thought, and I remember feeling no different, thinking, that's weird. And And I remember, you know, since then talking about to aspiring filmmakers how that happens. There isn't that moment where you reach that place and you're always the same person. You know, the job that you do, the work that you do is the same work that you do, whether you're getting paid or not. It's better to get paid than not. whether it's produced or not, it's the same process. And it's interesting that you bring this up because I feel like I have now gone through this kind of gauntlet, and I was lucky enough to get the opportunity. I was lucky enough to be part of that movie and work with all those people, and we were all lucky enough to have it go as well as it did. I sit here the way I would have sat here, you know, 10 years ago, the way I will probably sit here 10 years from now. It's like there is not that moment where you go, oh, it feels different. I don't know about you, but I whether it's a thing I've written or a thing that I've directed or whatever it is, I know I've done it, and I can talk about the process, but it's somehow impossible that it's happened, because when you get to the other side of it, you're the same exact person. You know, our experiences shape us a little bit, of course, but I just honestly, I feel gratitude and that I'm sitting here at all, and that I got to be part of something that was as much fun as Force Awakens.
Well, also enjoying the process too, that yeah. you have to really, and I think that's what people don't understand when they think of, when it's that finish line mentality. If you think of finish line mentality, you're usually going to be disappointed, because mm-hmm. then you're not going to, like you said, you're not going to feel any different. Then that's going to mess with your head, because you're going to go, why don't I feel any different? Yeah. What's wrong with me? Now yeah. I'm depressed. I got the thing. Well, so you really
how,
do have
how
to
do you feel having
work.
Gone through
no,
your,
the exact
your
same
first
thing,
movie.
And I think about this all the time, and I know you've said it on this show a bunch too, is that line from Parenthood. The movie Parenthood. Like, there's no spike the ball moments.
You never cross the finish line.
Right.
You
yeah.
never spike the ball.
Yeah, and I feel like, and you, of all
are
the spike
pirates
the ball
in that movie?
Moments.
Arr, I'm Jason Robards.
and you've had, like, one of the most, you would think, spike the ball kinds of moments in a variety of ways, getting that job and then nailing that job. But even then, we're hearing him say that it isn't that way. And I think that it's like, it's two things. It's like, one, it's the career thing of, okay, cool, I did this, but now like even getting this job was, first of all, pitching with the producers initially, and then getting a chance to pitch to JJ. So it was like, as excited as I was to get that opportunity, it's like, now I have to do that. Now I have to make that happen. And then him digging it, and then having to pitch the studio, and then having them dig it, and then the movie still needed to get greenlit, you know? So there's always a next thing. And then even making the movie, as amazing as that is, now it has to be fucking good.
Yeah.
I can't make a bad movie. I can't be the one guy who made a bad movie with JJ, you know, like, I'm the variable there. You know what I mean? Like, he's made all these amazing movies. So if this one sucks, it's like, well, whose fault is that? And then
yours.
And exactly.
No.
I was well aware. Trust me, the whole time.
I thought you were asking. Sorry.
So and then now having done this movie, it's like, now I gotta think of, okay, what's the next thing? It has to be better, you know. So career wise, always. But it's interesting the way that you say it, how it feels the same, because that to me was the big realization making this, was that on the one hand, it felt like technically nothing I'd ever done before. I'd never done something on this scale. But at the same time, it felt exactly like everything I'd done. It felt like making movies in my backyard with my best friends and action figures. And I think that's also why movies work. That's why stories work, because everyone feels the same feelings. Like when you were a kid and you had a crush on someone, that feeling that happened in you, the little butterflies and all that stuff, that's the same feeling that you have. And when you're afraid of something, that fear, that rush of fear that you feel, it's the same feeling. It might be of different things and about different things, but it's chemically the same process. So when you see things in a story that delight or make you feel, you know, you're going through those same emotions. That's why we can all sort of nod our heads and go, yeah, that feels true or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and the entertainment business friend zoned me for a long time, like every girl I had a crush on when I was a kid. But that feeling of accomplishment, you should register it a little bit, because I think you'll do probably 10 movies. You'll do 10 of something over the course of right. several years. You'll still feel the same. But then I think there's that Karate Kid moment where it's like, show me, send up. And you're like, oh, my God, how do I know all this stuff? And I didn't realize it's in my head.
Totally. And I think that's where JJ is, too. It's like, it's funny you say the Karate Kid thing, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. But it's also like, when you played Super Mario Brothers, and the first time you played, you're like inching towards every jump and being very careful and calculated. But then after you've died a million times because there's no saves in that game, the first levels you've like mastered, and then it's no, and you hold B to run through it.
Yeah.
And it's no longer about like just making the jump. It's like you're trying to put little
muscle memory.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all muscle memory. Yeah. But because I hope you know, and I mean, or that you have a, at least some concept of, you know, even if this movie doesn't make $1 billion,
right.
I think it's going to do really great.
Yeah.
But even if it, I think this is going to open so many. I mean, everyone, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is amazing in this movie,
yeah.
And John Goodman, like everyone is amazing in the movie. And without giving too much away, it's not really one genre of movie. It really kind of – I don't want to give it away again, but there's a lot of different things. But it's still a simple story,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an incredible thing.
Yeah, totally. I think that was what was exciting to us is that you're really that it combines genres, you know, and that I think there's parts of this movie that are very familiar and very similar to other movies. There's very much like Misery or Dead Calm in many ways. But then there's another way in which this movie functions that is kind of incomparable, which made it challenging. It was very hard to find comparison to other movies in broad. But that is super exciting. I think besides getting the chance to make a movie period and make a movie for Bad Robot, the idea of making something that would not be quiet. You know, I don't think there's a version that you walk out of this movie and shrug and go to dinner and just not talk about it. I think
yeah.
No matter what your feelings are, you will be talking about the movie when you walk out, which is a really awesome thing, especially in a time when TV is so awesome and you really want a reason to go to the theater. This is a great communal experience to have, not just for all the hopefully screams that occur amidst you but to really have an experience like, did we just watch that together? Did that just happen? Is a really cool thing.
Well, it's a story that you're always chasing as an audience member because every time you go, oh, because once you're in a movie, when you're watching a movie and you get to that point where you go, oh, I get it. It can be kind of over at that mm-hmm. point because then people kind of go on autopilot.
Right.
And if that happens early in a movie, then that's obviously early. But it's one of those movies where you go, oh, I think I get it. Oh, no. Okay, now I don't, you know. And mm-hmm. so it stays just – there's this kind of like story carrot that's just out of your reach that you are constantly mm-hmm. chasing mm-hmm. in the movie. And it really is fantastic. I'm curious when – what does someone have to pitch to you? What is a pitch to J.J. Abrams that makes you go, yeah, I think this is something that has to happen in a pitch for you to get behind it?
Obviously, you know, like any of us, it's like there's no one thing. It's sort of like saying, what's the joke that makes you laugh? It's like the funny one, you know?
Well, with farts.
I forgot who I was talking to. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Please.
But you know, this was a pitch I had heard before I read the script that was submitted. And it was – the idea was so compelling. You know, what happens if – you are in an accident and need saving, but what happens if the person that saved you might be crazy? And what happens if you're told it's incredibly dangerous outside, but then you realize it's terrifying inside? And it was just such a Twilight Zone, to go back to that, you know, example premise, that it immediately got me excited because I just felt like I want to see that movie. And then we started developing the story a little bit and playing with the genre stuff a little bit and just sort of pushing limits and doing things that made it clearly, overtly a kind of, you know, fever dream, insane thing that kind of defied easy description. And once Dan came on and came in and was so clear with a kind of tone and modulation and vision for it, a kind of grounded, it's as much a drama as anything, but that allows it to be really funny and really twisted and really terrifying and really unexpected. It just felt like, you know, though I had never met Dan, it felt like, oh my God, that's exactly what this movie needs. And I knew I was going to be going off to do a Star Wars movie. Lindsay Weber, the other producer, knew Dan beforehand and was such a champion for him, and I just trust Lindsay implicitly. And I just felt like, given my experience with Dan, given Lindsay, even though I was not going to be around for the shoot, it felt like such an obvious, you know, like any collaboration, leap of faith, but a risk to take. And the risk was a low risk. It wasn't a huge budget movie, and it was a very, you know, obviously accomplished storyteller and someone who, while he hadn't done a feature before, was a wonderful communicator of the movie he wanted to make. And I think you did literally the exact thing you said you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Of course, making discoveries along the way and as you always do, but it was a great collaboration. I loved it.
Well, when you go off to make a Star Wars movie, do you basically say to everyone, unless the building is on fire, do not bother me because I need to focus on this?
You know, we have there were some things that went sideways while I was away. There were some TV projects we had that did not go in any way the way we wanted it to. There were some things that I wish had happened differently. And, you know, part of it is who you're collaborating with and making sure that you're making the best possible choices. Part of it is my being delinquent. When I was working on the Star Wars movie, I should have known how unavailable I was going to be. And even if I had been available, who's to say I would have helped anything? It might have, you know, it might have gone so much better than it had if I'd been involved. So you know, you never quite know. And like, I mean it, everything's a leap of faith. You never know, you know, when you sit down to do every, you know, interview, you can't know if it's going to be as boring as this one with me right now. You can't know. You know, you never would have shown up.
I'm sorry. What'd you say?
I'm sorry. I just
drifted off for a second.
Nudge Chris. But I do think that there are, you know, that there are things that I had to overlook when I was in London working on that movie. But I was doing post here for over a year in this building. So I got to at least, you know, get to be witness to or pulled into things that for one reason or another might need my attention.
But even when he was shooting, I was very impressed that, because I would think all I'd want to do is think about that movie. I would not want anything entering my focus. But we would still, he would watch all of our dailies, and the idea of him being on the Millennium Falcon looking at shots that we were concocting was overwhelming.
But they were really laughing, that's so crazy.
I know, it's insane. Laughing. The actual, not like a pretend one that the real one, the actual one.
But they were really fun dailies to watch, honestly. And it wasn't like it was a headache that I had to, you know, it was a little bit like when we were not shooting, when we were waiting for things, as anyone who's been on a set knows, there are long pauses where you're waiting for the thing to be set up.
You mean Harrison Ford?
No, hardly. He was the last person we were waiting for. By the way, Harrison, it should be known, would arrive on set before they would ever call for him. And he would be there ready to go. He is so consummate professional, mm-hmm. you know, the definition of consummate professional. So the very truth is that he was the last person we were waiting for. There were other people, Boyega. But listen, it was always fun watching these dailies.
Well, the great thing about Harrison Ford is at Comic-Con a few years ago, he was surly Harrison Ford.
Right. I remember, like, I was there.
The handcuff?
For Cowboys vs. Aliens.
Yeah. Actually, no. It was for Ender's Game.
Oh, Ender's Game.
Yeah. Cowboys vs. Aliens was the year there was the stabbing.
Yes, which I was there. I was sitting two rows away from it.
I was there for that, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
Wasn't Ender's Game after Cowboys and Aliens?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, but he was there for Cowboys.
He was there for Cowboys for sure.
He was there for Cowboys first, which I think was 2011 maybe, and then two or three years ago for Ender's Game.
Yeah.
And he was surly Harrison Ford, you know, like – people would get up to ask a question and be like, what would Han Solo say if he met Indiana Jones? And be like, hello.
Yeah.
Like, he was that guy. So it was like, he was pretend grouchy, but maybe a little grouchy too.
Right.
But at the panel we did this past year, he was so, seemed genuinely moved by everything. He seemed so into it and thankful and gracious, and he was really, really lovely.
You could not be more right, honestly.
I don't know what changed, or if he was just in a good – I don't know what it was, but it really
– I imagine this is actually a part of the equation, is starting to work on Star Wars again, but with someone who, you know, was making it awesome and not
– Well, look, I've known Harrison since 1990 when we did Regarding Henry. And getting to work with him in this way, which, you know, was a scary proposition, you know, to direct him, not just to be writing something, but to direct him, and not just direct Harrison Ford, but him as Han Solo. It was like impossible to know what that would be like. And then when that accident happened and he was hurt and he was off for a little while, I think that the combination of being back in this role, of being reminded of your mortality, of being in a role where the character, you know, literally meets his demise in the movie, there are all these things that were like, I think it's a very different thing to be where he is now in his life and be dealing with those stories and being, you know, 30-something years old and doing Return of the Jedi and begging to be killed. I think that there's a sort of, you know, as Han Solo himself has, I think Harrison, you know, he's lived these years. He's a wiser guy than he was. He's so brilliant. I've never worked with an actor who knows the thing to do before you would ever ask him to do it. Like, you know, he knows where the camera is. He is so like the last great movie star. You know, he's like, he is that guy, and he just knows exactly what needs to happen. I more often than not would throw an idea out to him. He would sort of complete the sentence and do the thing, and I would just say thank you. Like, it was like he knew how to do it in the next take, as opposed to getting there and spending 4 or 5 takes to make it work. But I think that his appreciation for being this guy in this movie with this cast, that he had so much fun with Daisy, he had so much fun with Boyega, and he it was like watching him with Carrie again. They would laugh, like the things that they would say, and she's so, you know, out there with her brilliant, you know, humor, and he got it, and it was like a little bit of a reunion that they got to celebrate because they could appreciate doing it, which you can't do when you're 20 or 30 years old.
Right.
Understanding how this business works, understanding how lucky we all are to be here at all. You know, they came to the party with knowing what the rest of the world is like, you know, knowing what it is to, you know, be out there and see people who they know, you know, maybe not have the lives, the careers that they did, maybe not even be alive anymore. You know what I mean? Here they are, not only still standing, but as good as ever. And I think that they could appreciate the opportunity. And it was beautiful to see.
Well, now, okay, so this is the perfect time for my pitch it's called Regarding Henry. So when he lands at the bottom of the thing after he's been stabbed by Kylo Ren, he's not dead. He doesn't die. He just forgets who he is.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they has to be rehabilitated. Yes. And then Leia's got to come in. And it's a whole separate, you know, it's basically
awesome.
Like,
instead of Ajax, it's R2 or something. Yeah, that he's repeating.
You know, so it's a different type of a story in this universe. Because I feel like the Star Wars universe is expansive enough.
What's it called?
Regarding Henry.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to see if you had the guts to say it again.
Because amazing. You know that it's such an amazing idea that you're going to go do it, right. So you just wanted to make sure
it was
that
funny.
I was okay.
There was, in the year the movie came out, there was a porn film called Regarding Heine.
Yes, I remember that.
And I bought it.
I didn't see it, I just remembered.
I remember I had the box on a shelf when you first come into my house I lived in. And anyway, and my friend David Spade came over one day. He was like, what's this? And he opened the box and he took the tape and he never gave it back.
You really want it back at this point?
Yeah, I don't know where the box is either.
Up his spot
but
right now.
He took that tape. So
well, there were a handful of like when they started really parodying mainstream films, was like Edward
Jurassic
Penis
Pork,
Hands, Jurassic Pork, Regarding Heine,
Saving Ryan's Privates.
Yeah, all that stuff. There's a really
classic.
Totally.
Yeah, and so I just think the Star Wars universe could handle a family.
Just say one more time.
He didn't even
say one more time.
You really went back in. You're really persistent.
Regarding Henry. Regarding Henry.
I think it's awesome. I actually always wanted – I can't believe I'm taking this road with it, but the Darth Maul's demise, I always felt
– Mallrats?
Like he was gonna come back with like a robotic
– Well, that was the whole thing.
Then it happened in Rebels or
did,
the cartoon. Yeah.
They did.
But I wanted that to be – I thought no brain – because it was, as we all know, nobody, no death in genre roles, you know, so I felt like no way he's not
right. You know, it's just one of those – it is one of those universes that literally is its own separate industry, because even if you did like a Spinal Tap tour documentary with Figure and Dan and the modal nodes, I would watch it. Like there's so much there's everything's so granular, and every character, everything is something that you could branch off and entirely be its own thing.
Agreed.
And when we did the panel last year, we had this rehearsal the night before. And I think the thing that was the most impressive to me, because I was already excited about seeing it, I was already super jazzed. Your Instagram videos of, because I remember when Force Awakens, when the name first came out, people were like, Force Awakens, what's this about? Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit of, huh, what? Mm. And then you posted that first Instagram video and people were like, oh, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute, you know? And then watching the excitement build up through Comic-Con last year. And seeing you and Frank Marshall and Kathleen Kennedy and Brian Burke and
Larry Kasdan.
And Larry Kasdan.
Yeah, not Frank.
I'm not Frank, but Frank
was actually there. Was he there for Jurassic?
He was in the rehearsal because he was there with Kathleen.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And Lawrence Kasdan as well. But you were all laughing, but you were also very human about the whole thing, and it wasn't like a, boy, we're sure going to make a lot of money on this. You know, you were so sincere about, I just want people to like it. I care about it. I don't know if people are going to like it. I think they are, but this is really important to me. Mm-hmm. And that it was almost like a fan approach to them. It's almost kind of a fan film in a weird sort of way. Do you feel that? Feel like that?
You know, I don't know if anyone working on a saga or a series of movies or even a show, you know, on some level – it isn't doing that because it pre-exists. My guess is the people who are doing it are doing it because they love it, that they care about it. So you could argue that that's true.
But you said you weren't that huge of a Star Trek fan and you still made a good Star Trek movie.
True, but I also have said that in working on it, I actually started to see the things that, you know, I wish I'd given more of a shot when I was growing up because I had friends who loved it and mm-hmm. I just never did. And I started to love it, you know, as a late adopter. But I loved it because I'd gotten to know it. And I saw how powerful those relationships were and what Roddenberry had created and the whole sort of paradigm and that notion of unity and the optimistic future. And there were so many things that I hadn't appreciated just because I'd never really given it the chance. But I think that with you know, going to Comic-Con with that movie, with the trailer, it was you know, the behind-the-scenes featurette thing. It was a very it was another scary, you know, sort of threshold to cross, because it was like every time we revealed something, we didn't know what the hell the reaction was going to be. And of course, we anticipated that there would always be blowback from some corners and some people. And of course, there are. I mean, you're never going to make something that everyone's going to like. Except this podcast, apparently.
Of course.
but it's an amazing thing to you know, see how generous the fans were. And it's really a testament to how much they wanted to go back to that place that George created, that they love so much.
I just think seeing people, you know, some of whom have been working in the business for a long time, still having the kind of child, especially, I mean, Kathleen Kennedy is someone that I completely worship. I mean, she is partially responsible for almost everything that I love.
You know what's amazing? Have you ever been to her office?
No. Can I?
No, she's not. She's only good. She's only good. Right, yeah. No, but you should break in because there's a shelf that she has near her desk that just happens to have like all the great American movies, and she's produced all of them.
Yeah.
Like,
really? You have a great collection. I love those movies.
And you forget could name all the movies that she produced, and you would be leaving out half the movies she produced. You can't believe the movies she's made, and it is, she's unbelievable. And you can talk about something and she can sort of nod and say yes and then tell her personal story, having been involved in the actual creation of the, you know, prep, the shoot, the post of films that, you know, are the obvious ones and then the ones that you don't even remember that she was involved in. Do you think, dear God, mm-hmm. how did she do all this? It's just, she's unbelievable.
And when you talk to her, it's kind of the same thing. We're like, well, I don't know. This is just a thing that we did. We solved these problems. And that's kind of, that's what's kind of exciting for you, I would imagine, as you're sort of standing on the precipice of this now, this career, this hopefully long career ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And there might be a point in 30 or 40 years where you're like, how did you make, you know, that regarding Henry, which was such a great title
well,
that you
I
had to go
it.
Make it.
I was like,
no one's going to say that.
JJ was so in love
no
with it.
No one's going to say that.
They said, Dan, you got to rush out and make this movie.
Right, right.
And, you know, and I'm sure for you.
Was that Jason Robards?
No. Jason Robards is here for your treasure.
Yeah, forget that.
he's off to find Peter Pan. I've made him Irish now, or like a weird. I don't know.
Wait, what was the Peter? What's the Peter Pan thing with Jason?
I made him a pirate. Oh, okay. And so then I turned him into Captain Hook.
Got it.
And then I just assumed that he was trying to find Peter Pan.
Got it.
Are you gonna pitch Parent Hook?
You never cross the finish line. You never spike
Let's
the
talk about
ball,
Dan's career.
Whatever that
Dan's
means.
Career.
No, you know what I was going to say though when you were talking about Force Awakens, the title, and how appreciative JJ always seemed about making and all that stuff. What I thought was so cool, I can't believe if I ever mentioned this to you or not, but I thought about it a lot. Was that I feel like I'm sure there's a lot of bad versions of doing a Star Wars movie again, but I think that there's also probably a number of good versions as well. But it was the way you guys chose to make it, like specifically that title, is genius. And it's functioning in for the movie's purposes, for the actual story that the movie's telling, but it's also functioning in a way
for the audience.
For the audience, but then also all of the marketing, the first teaser, and then that thing, and then finally getting to Chewie, we're home. Like those were
where every grown man cried in front of their computer
that is
when
really
that happened.
Acknowledging the audience's relationship to the movie and the story of the movie, the way that the movie unfolds, you always feel like it's speaking. You're so invested in the story because it feels like you. Like the fact that there's a character who heard of Luke Skywalker but isn't sure if it's true. You know, all those things.
Well, that's what got me excited when I first talked to Kathy about it. And then we knew in the materials, in the teasers, that we needed to talk to the fans. Mm. We needed to say, we're with you in this way. And so that there was an intention there. But it was, you know, every step was terrifying because you just don't know is it going to work.
That's the interesting part is you as the filmmakers having this meta conversation with the audience of like, we know what you're worrying about. We know it's going to be okay. This is, you know, it's in good hands. Although I would have pitched this as an opening. Everyone gets on the screen. Everyone sits down. The shooters come back and the screen opens. And then Jar Jar comes on and just goes, it's a me, everybody. And then a lightsaber just cuts him in half and his body folds in half and then the crawl. So if you wanted to do that for like a DVD,
maybe for Regarding Henry, that can be the opening.
See, it even sees.
Yeah, I'm picking up
next
on
project.
It. I'm next generation.
I'm telling JJ, it's going to be 3 o'clock in the morning. And Regarding Henry's going to pop into your head, and you're going to start getting ideas for it. It's going to be a brain worm that's going to infect your brain.
It already is. It already is. I'm already thinking about things.
Well, are you already thinking about the next thing? Have you already thought about the next thing, or are you just trying to get through Cloverfield?
We finished this movie very recently, and which is awesome. Which is the blessing and the curse of technology now is that you can finish so soon. And I'm sure, like on Mission Impossible, you probably there was still film prints, and it wasn't. We weren't where we are now, so you weren't able to cut down, be down to the wire so much. But the idea we can really make things as perfect as we want to make them is so awesome and such a privilege. But it means that we really were working until the very last second. So I was so focused on that. I mean, there was some things. There was a movie that I had in development before making this. Called Crime of the Century. It's like a big science fiction heist movie that is super cool and really original and something that I would love to do. That we'd still be developing on. So there's no big next thing.
You said something that I want to ask both of you about, which is, you know, you can make things perfect do you ever – do you feel like the pursuit of this kind of amorphous idea of perfection
is not. In fact, after we've seen it – after the premiere – I was like, there's still some things that I was. He's like, it's 98% awesome. It's 98%, you know, like you can't. It's really hard, and you kind of. I do. I mean, I get the temptation to always want to go back and make the movie as good as it possibly can. I understand that in a new way now, for sure.
Do you have a definitive moment where you go, aha, it's done? Or do you always feel like, if I just had more time, if I just had more this, if I just had more that?
You know, you always want more time and. At the same time, you know, because it's a collaboration and I try to surround myself not by yes people, but by tire kickers, people who go, I don't know, you know, let's look at it again. Let's, you know, and so sometimes I will be feeling like, I think this is what this sequence needs to be or what, you know, even the whole movie. And I'll have someone, you know, in the case of Force Awakens, it was either like Michelle Rejwan, who was one of the producers, or Brian Burke, one of the producers, who, you know, the editors too, who had sort of, you know, nudge me and say, this isn't as funny as it could be, I don't think, or this doesn't really land, or I'm not feeling that. So it sort of, you know, you go into it as many times as you can and you sort of look at it, and of course you lose your perspective and you sort of bring in some people you trust who can tell you, you know, from the outside. But, you know, the thing that I'm always so envious of is that, you know, that kid who's drawing a picture in class and, you know, the little kid, and then they're like, I'm done. And you're like, oh.
You're okay with that?
Now, part of it might be that they just want to go out and play. Part of it might be that they're, you know, easily distracted. But I do think that there is a moment where you can work on things, overthink things, and go too far and begin to shave off. One of the things I admire enormously about what Dan did in 10 Cloverfield Lane is he really let things hold. And you could argue in this age of, you know, insanely quick cuts that this movie, if you were to almost to look on the editing, you know, timeline, the Avid timeline, my guess is that this movie has infinitely fewer cuts than most movies that are coming out now, because the movie is just so confidently told, is so still in its storytelling, and allows things to sink in and seep in and go deeper. And it's the thing that I think allows it to get under your skin and makes it a unique experience, in addition to, of course, the performances and the camera work and everything. But there's something about the pace of it. And I love that you didn't work on it so concerned with, you know, trying to keep it moving at all times. You know, it was not about the speed. It was about the tension. It was about the terror. It was about the, you know, the reality of the moment. And it required that you hold on moments so that the main character can really start to piece it together. And the audience is with her, I think, at every step. I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead is truly remarkable in this movie. I think she did an amazing job.
Agreed.
And I think it was because Dan allowed it to breathe, allowed it to sort of, you know, happen. And I think you can you know, you can make mistakes in any direction, but I really loved how you allowed the movie to sort of find its rhythm and not get so close to it that you were just almost getting bored with it and wanting to kind of, you know, get it going. Because the movie could have probably been 5 minutes shorter and arguably just the same, you know, story, but the fact that it lets it just sit and lets things, you know, simmer, I just think is what makes it as powerful as it is.
What's your favorite part of the process?
Actually, it was the prep phase, because there's so much promise. Then, like, the movie can be, we haven't shot it yet. We weren't looking at the footage. We aren't like, oh, I wish I had this or that or whatever. Everything you're talking about is all very exciting. There was something very cool about going to an office every day. This is a job that you don't often, at least for me, you know, I'm not going to an office. And as a kid, I always really envied the idea of, like, wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase and having things in a briefcase that I went to an office for. And I'm sure I would actually hate that job, but this came the closest. I had an office. We would all have meetings and with sterile lighting and talk about the blueprints and the design of the set. And there was just something cool looking around and standing amongst grown men and women taking very seriously the idea of make-believe, you know, it's like, this is the same thing that we would talk about as kids in our backyard, but we're adults. And this is, we all have to take it very seriously. We really need to build this and all that, but it's all to help further the character or the story or make this exciting thing happen. And, like, that is so much fun.
And I will tell you, the very thing you're saying is the same thing that Steven Spielberg still to this day feels and talks about, which is that this amazing, how lucky it is to get to be part of that. And it's not that you or he are in any way unsophisticated. It's like, it's that childlike appreciation,
right,
for the process of getting to create an illusion and play make-believe and then show it to people, you know. And it's like, that's the thing that, as you are beginning your career, it's like, you know, that's the thing I think that is critical to hold on to, is never lose sight of how lucky it is to take the job very seriously and sort of laugh every step of the way and appreciate how impossible it is that we get to do this at all.
And, well, JJ's really, I want to say too, because it speaks to that.
Handsome?
Yes, smokingly handsome.
It's so obvious.
Striking. I mean,
striking. Yeah.
I can't
even look at
you guys.
It's
okay? Like Star Tours. Like, it's okay? So striking that I'm going to get
you to vomit.
Yeah, because it's so, like, I just... I'm overwhelmed.
It's intense. It's very intense. Yeah. JJ very much encourages trying to accomplish hi-fi results in a lo-fi way. Specifically, there's the car crash in the beginning of the movie, and we had done some stuff on a gimbal, this really sophisticated piece of equipment that shakes a car and moves around and all that stuff. And he really championed the idea of getting some additional stuff that could be more intimate with the character, all we needed was her performing the hell out of it and moving the camera around. And that stuff is the better moments of that car accident. And not only didn't make the movie better, didn't make the story better, didn't make the scene better, but it also made the process more fun. Like, I found myself like, oh, this is so much more rewarding. You're right. It really is pulling off a magic trick. Like, people don't even know. It's one thing for them to think something looks cool when you made it using a cool tool.
Right.
It's another thing to do it in the most homegrown way possible and it still look as expensive as, you know, that is a special kind of rewarding feeling. That he is, you know, huge on and really encouraged that throughout the whole process. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Is there anything specific that you took away from the Star Wars movie? When you got to the other side of it, what did you feel like? You must learn loads every time you get behind a camera and go through that process. What did you learn the most from this?
It's really what Dan is talking about, which is that the moments that you need, some of the most important moments are things that you have to sometimes get later, that you have to, you know, we shot nearly 10 minutes of the movie here in the stage next door, and it was getting moments, getting shots, getting pieces that were missing from the scenes when we were shooting them. And sometimes it was rewriting things, but a lot of times it was about these incredible, critical, intimate moments that when you're shooting a big sequence or you're shooting anything, you're getting, you know, obviously the big gross motor function stuff, you know, you need, but when it gets to sort of the fine motor skill thing, sometimes you just don't have the focus because you're trying to make the day. You got to make sure you're getting the stuff. So for example, when we were shooting the first Star Trek movie we did, there's that whole scene near the opening when the young Kirk is stealing the Corvette and he's driving in the car and he's being chased by a cop. And we shot this whole thing over a couple days and we had this kid on this rig and we had this, you know, cop vehicle that was on this arm that was, you know, allowing. So it was a huge thing in the middle of farmland, and it was just, we had a ton of stuff to get, and we got all of it that we could and that we needed to, and we cut the whole thing together. And when it came to doing a trailer for the movie, they showed me this one cut, and it had this moment with the kid, and I thought, God, you know, it's just so not as good as it needs to be. And I had never really thought, we hadn't reshot anything for that movie. And I thought, you know, God, if we could only get, we were doing the sound mix at Fox. If we could only get that shot of that kid and change his reading. And they said, well, why don't you shoot it? And I thought, oh, of course. You know, I hadn't done that. And we didn't really do any reshoots on Mission 3 either. So I thought, okay, great. Let's try that. So while we were doing the mix, we went to the parking garage at Fox. We got the car because I said, well, if we're going to do that, I'd love to get a couple close-ups of the kid in the car. So it was very much like the car crash with Michelle. So we mm-hmm. got the kid, and he had to wear a wig because his hair was different entirely. And he showed up, and we had the car, and we did the beat where young Kirk sort of stands up, having just almost fallen into this big, you know, quarry. And he stands up to basically say what his name is. James T. Kirk. And so while we had the kid, I also got him driving. It's a long story, but it has a point. And so we then got him driving. We just shook the camera and had the kid. But there are 11 shots in that sequence that we shot at the Fox parking lot that are of the kid driving, him looking back, him screaming and kind of rebellion, all these things that we just didn't know we needed exactly when we were shooting with the Russian arm and the car and the rig and the kid. And so you just, the answer to your question is, you know, you learn in the editing room, you know, always what you wish you had to make the sequence that much more fun, that much funnier. And the thing you never will regret is getting those close-ups of mm-hmm. the actors, of the characters, of their eyes, of their experience. Because it's literally the thing that keeps the audience in the scene. And you can have the coolest, biggest, craziest, you know, CG fest ever. But none of it will matter if you're just looking at figures of, you know, people at a distance or a God's eye view. It's like you need to be in the face of the characters, I think, to – and it sounds maybe obvious, but I see it again and again and again. When I look at a sequence that I've done, I realize I don't feel a thing. And I realize, oh, my God, I'm missing that moment. So, for example, when Rey and Kylo Ren are fighting in the woods with the lightsabers, and there's that moment when he says, you know, I can show you the ways of the Force – and she hears the Force and she closes her eyes, and then you see him looking at her and her eyes are closed. And then, you know, she sort of lets it in. We did that, you know, next door, and we did those shots, which had never been part of the script or whatever, because I knew when we were cutting it, I was missing the turning point moment where she goes from almost being on the edge of you know, the cliff, almost meeting her demise, to turning the tables and fighting back. And so we did that here, and it made the scene powerful, and it was literally as close as you could possibly get to her face, and it was all about her eyes, all about his eyes. But when we were at Pinewood shooting on that massive stage with, you know, literally hundreds of trees and, you know, hundreds of people, and it was just, you know, getting those close-ups, we just didn't think to do it because you're just trying to make the days work. So it's the same thing. That lesson is the same lesson that I think you learn whether you're doing an episode of a TV show, the first film you're doing, or the latest Star Wars movie. It's always the same kind of thing. You have to get those details or nothing will work.
So just out of curiosity, so it is Luke her father? Like, do you want to just and then what happens next?
Right.
Can you
– I'll give you Ryan's number and you can call him. Ask him. The only thing that I love about not directing the next movie is that, like, I get to forward everything to Ryan.
Yeah.
I mean, that is kind of a – that must feel like a
yeah, but that won't. People are still going to bug him. I mean, they're really going to bug him.
Oh, yeah.
That's not going to – I mean, you
I'm just going to get business cards with Ryan's phone number printed out there.
You know what you stepped into. I mean, it is – I think it's an amazing universe, but it's also
– Actually, we'll know. We will stop bugging you because we're going to know. Like, that's what's so cool. We're going to find out. Like, that's not it's not the end of Jedi. It's,
but you know,
like, we're having more.
But it's also, but it's like you said, well, you never know how the audience is going to react. And I interviewed George Lucas for something like four years ago. And off camera, he was very personable and conversational. But then when we started the official thing, he just like totally buttoned up. And he wouldn't really give an opinion on anything. And I realized, like, oh, yeah, because every time he opens his mouth – half the people are like, you're a genius. And half the people are like, you suck. You know, and it's just like he just doesn't want to, you know, the thing is bigger than he is. So are you okay with just letting it all kind of be whatever it's going to be?
Look, the entering this world was without question it was unknown territory. It was a risky thing. It obviously is. It means so much to so many people. So it can be like a divisive thing, any decision. There are immediate opinions about, but I also know that it was an opportunity of a lifetime, and I'm thrilled to have been part of it. I also know it is bigger than George. It's bigger than all of us. I mean, that thing he created, which, you know, there's all sorts of sort of revisionist history about what was written at the beginning and what everyone always knew. But the fact is, we all saw it was called Revenge of the Jedi until it was called Return of the Jedi. Like, we know things changed as they went along. It's like, that's beautiful. And it's what storytelling is. And it's cool. No way did anyone, I think, predict what Star Wars was going to mean. You know, even if he did think there would be a few movies or six movies or nine movies, whatever it is, like, you cannot predict something like that. So the power of entering, you know, the power of Star Wars and entering that world, you know, it really doesn't matter in some ways what any of us say. It's sort of – it's its own thing that so many people invest in, and certainly, you know, not the least of which are the fans.
And I just think it's really great to hear, and I think it's really great, especially for young content creators or young or old. It doesn't matter. But just the idea that, you know, the process is what's important. Being flexible sounds like the most important thing, being able to sort of be structured but – flexible in the moment, because you never know what's
going to
happen.
But I think Dan did this, and it does not matter what it is. It's always the same thing. But to be open to the better idea at every stage.
Yeah.
You want to speak to that at all?
Yeah. The thing I realized early on, too, in it being my first thing, that it'd be stupid for me to pretend like it wasn't my first thing. And I really loved that we found awesome collaborators in every position. And I never wanted to tell anyone this is – I mean, there are some things, certainly, when you're visioning something, some things that you, like, see very clearly and, like, I really want it to be that way. I think that'd be so great. And how do we navigate things to get it to be that way? But there are also so many things where I know what I want it to feel like. I know this much about it. But I really want to listen to what you have to say, my production designer or my cinematographer or whatever. Because if you're just telling everyone what to do, then the thing will only be as good as what you can come up with. But if you listen to other people, like, it has a chance of being much better than what your one mind can think of. So that the whole time and trying to be egoless about things, because ultimately like every genius thing that JJ said, but then he would then he would like regret and like, oh, maybe that's not good. Like I often had to like convince, like some of working with him was saying, no, we need to do that thing you said. That thing you said is awesome. Let's do that.
One of my favorite things about working with you is that all of us in whatever room it was, editing room, visual effects review, you know, mixing
like this
stage
for a while. Yeah,
no, but it was you were open to the better idea and you knew, as I think one must, that it doesn't always come from you.
Yeah,
it comes from the person who's been really focusing on that thing, or the person who got a life perspective that's not yours at all, who says, well, what wouldn't she think, feel this? In the case of you know, Michelle, this is a female character who, you know, I know this sounds obvious, but having people like Lindsay Weber to fight for what she thought Michelle, you know, should or should not be about, you know, what her sort of story is. I mean, we changed some fundamental ideas about kind of where she came from and where she was going at the end of the movie, partly because we wanted to build her up. And so Lindsay had amazing ideas, as did other people. But I just loved how the process was about, you know, being comfortable and safe to throw out ideas, good or bad, and let them, you know, we used to have this thing working on Alias back in the day where we would always say, you know, let it suck for a second, which is like, it's
yes,
okay.
Totally.
It's
totally
okay to talk about it in the worst way and to say, you know, here's a pitch. And if someone were to say, well, come on, that's no good. It's like, well, hold on a second. Just let it. Let's talk about it for a second. Because
that's a great bit of advice.
If the version that sucks, you know, actually has a chance, it actually might develop into something that proves itself to be really powerful. And you were always open to that.
That is the one thing that I have a very I don't want to say short leash. It's not like I ever get that angry, but things that I have a hard time with are when people like laugh at ideas or get dismissive about things or judge things, because everything sounds really silly when you're first saying, or not everything, but things can sound really silly. And sometimes those things, even things that someone would say, I mean, I don't want to be specific, but there's a cool moment that someone threw out in one of our reviews, and it was really silly idea when they first said it. And then I was like, wait, that actually would be awesome. We should definitely do that, you know? And it's you really do need to let things suck for a second and just always explore everything's worth exploring.
You mean it's that moment where John Goodman turns into a Godzilla creature?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that
I didn't mean to give
really
that away.
Good. Yeah,
I didn't mean to give that away.
Well,
I think when you're faced with those moments, I think the most important thing you can do is go, okay, well, how could we make it work? I feel like we focus a lot. I focus a lot on this podcast about like ask good questions. So if all these things, if they seem ridiculous, how could they work? Because then if you still can't come up with an answer, then maybe it wouldn't work. But maybe someone has something that collaboratively will create something better.
That's interesting.
Than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think asking good questions is the most important. I'm not saying I do it all the time.
No. Yeah,
that's what
absolutely.
I would like.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to do.
Yeah.
So I guess we're about wrapping up. This is it.
Sad. I'm sad it's over.
Should we come back every...
Yeah. Every Star Wars?
Come back every Star Wars.
There's been a lot of them too, so yeah.
Is your brain in any one moment just in 9 different directions? How do you focus?
No, I mean, there are times when there are a few fires that are being put out at one time, but, typically, and I don't know if this is just an ADD thing. If I'm turning a bug into a feature, I can't tell if it's good or bad. But I'm able to be present in the room I'm in, you know, even though the next room will be a different
podcast?
Different story. Yeah, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but
Mark Maron's in the other room.
Let's just say, and he's not happy. Right, right. But I'm, you know, you must feel the same. You're probably prepping, editing, you know, a bunch of things at once, right?
Yeah, but I also, I like you, I mean, there might be peripheral parts of my brain that are forming things that I know I will have to address, but I am usually pretty good at, like, this is what I'm doing right now, and this is what's important, and this is what I can focus on. And then I'll deal with that other shit later, and if I don't get to it today, then I'll deal with it when I can deal with it. It's just, like, not putting too much pressure to do everything at once.
Yeah, well, the thing I'm learning is just to say no to certain things, like to not get involved in certain things, because it's easy to distract yourself with so many different things, and suddenly you're not giving the best of yourself to any of them. And also when you have kids and a wife and, you know, or a husband, and you're like, you have a life that needs to be more than just distraction, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, that's, it can be dangerous to be in too many rooms.
I think
at one
people
time.
Can get addicted to the, like, the ideation process, because you get that rush of adrenaline, like, this sounds amazing, you know. But I think there's a separate skill set with maintenance, like the maintaining things, seeing them through. That's an unsexy process.
Mm. True. However, the reason that the other side of that, I guess, a little bit is the reason that I wanted to try and have a production company was for this reason. We would not be sitting here if there wasn't some of that. And this idea that came to us, that we got excited about and we started talking about, this was long before Dan was involved, was one of those situations. And you have to kind of, you never know exactly when to say yes or when to say no, but you have to try and figure out, like, what's your gut? That's the only kind of litmus test you've got, I think. And the fact that we're sitting here talking about this movie, which I'm proud to be associated with, I think, Dan, you did an extraordinary job with, that came out of the desire to have people like Lindsay Weber, who works here, who was able to shoulder that. So while I was off, you know, working on something else, she was able to make part of her day job, and she's got her own, you know, array of things, developing and producing this movie, which, by the way, she did with a newborn and you know, was in New Orleans.
Amazing.
And she, I mean, she was juggling a million things at once. So we all are on some level, but finding the right people who share a similar, you know, excitability about certain things, who are really good at what they do, you don't need to micromanage. It helps. Mm. You know, I couldn't ever have, I would not be here if I didn't have the people who work at this company.
But there is something, you do also have to take credit for being able to attract good quality people who want to be. I mean, would you say Kathy Kennedy is a mentor? Was Kathy one of your mentors?
It's very weird you even say that, because I've told the story before, but quickly, when I was 16, Kathy Kennedy called Matt Reeves and me to ask if we would repair these 8mm films that Stephen had made when he was a kid. And it happened because we were in a film festival and she read about us in the LA Times. And so we, of course, said yes, and we did the repairs. And then years later, I got to meet Stephen. Joel Mazursky and I went in for a meeting. Actually, it was about a Roger Rabbit sequel. And
What?
Yeah.
Whoa. Hang on a second.
Mic drop.
No. Wait. You don't just gloss over that.
Yeah.
What was that? Just real quick. What was that?
It was a whole thing. I actually even have some storyboards for a Roger Rabbit.
What?
Short.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a whole thing.
No. Hang on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Yes, I do want to hear the rest of the Kathy Kennedy story. Could you just give us a minute version of what the sequel of Roger Rabbit was supposed to be?
First, you have to do your best Roger Rabbit voice.
Oh, please don't make me do that. Okay, I already said regarding Henry like 12 times.
You did.
And I already hate myself.
And by the way, the last time was sad. I gotta be like, okay.
Ah.
No, honestly, it was, we never really even got to that phase. We were writing an outline, and it just honestly, it went away before it was anything. But this was a long time ago.
Was there
this
a Zemeckis involvement with that too, or no?
He probably would have been a producer on it.
Right, but
this was 1989. Mm-hmm. This was about 20 years before the internet was born. So, in any event, we're at that meeting, and it was the first time I met Steven. And at the end of the meeting, I said, you know, Mr. Spielberg, just need to say that a few years ago, Matt Reeves and he stopped me, and he goes, no, I know, you repaired the movies that I made. And he, like, knew. And then he said, and I will never forget this, and I did not understand it at all, and frankly, I still don't quite understand it, but he said in that moment, Kathy Kennedy says that you're her protege. And I was like, what the hell? Like, it was the weirdest thing. I mean, who the hell knows? In any event, and it was literally 30 years later that she called to ask if I'd be interested in working on Star Wars. And so she has been, as a movie goer, you know, kind of an idol, an inspiration, an icon. And personally, she's been someone that watching how she deals with all of her projects and her two kids, you know, and being in a marriage with this amazing other powerhouse producer, you know, Frank Marshall. Like, she's unbelievable. So I don't know how you know Kathy and whether she feels this way or not. You know, I don't know how you not look at her as a mentor, no matter who you are, because she's just an incredible, accomplished.
Well, I think that's producer. I think mentorship is one of the most important things that you can that you can be a part of, because good mentors, I think when people go bad, it goes back to Karate Kid, you know, bad, those teachers say, that's student, right. Do you, that's know it. Like, bad, no such thing as a bad student, only a bad teacher,
right.
And so you were able to have this amazing group of mentors, Kathleen Kennedy and Spielberg and all these people, and then you get to, there's almost this kind of hereditary thing where you get totally. To pass that down to people like Dan, and then hopefully someday you will then be able to, so in a weird kind of way, your kind of spiritual emotional DNA really does get passed down through all these amazing people to people like Dan.
Yeah, totally. Wait, I want to ask a question about
Roger Rabbit
multitasking thing and Roger Rabbit. I'm so curious if you, when we're talking about all the different things that are going on and focusing, which you are so good at, which I've witnessed, but like, do you, because I struggle with this, do you allow yourself, if you have multiple things that you know you need to be figuring out, whether it's the movie that you're currently working on or another idea that you have for something or a TV, whatever, do you sort of allow, when something pops up, do you allow yourself to start thinking about that? Or do you say, no, this is what I need to focus on right now? I'm in the shower, when you're driving, whatever. Do you like assign time to be thinking about that, or you just let it happen and hopefully the ideas will come when they need to come?
I don't know how to be prescriptive like that and to say, this is how I'm going to split up my time and the ideas will come at 9:45 to, you know.
Right.
I mean, I know you don't mean that literally.
Or do you like,
But it's like I often find myself in a meeting on something and then there will be something that will trigger and it'll have nothing to do with that and I'll jot it down or I'll forget it. But it'll be one of those, you know, things that – I like having multiple things going on,
right.
But I also know that feeling when there are either too many things or I've said yes to certain things that aren't, they can't quite withstand the test of time. Mm. And you get to a place where you go, you know, and by the way, this is obviously a long process. Any movie is years in the making. And so there are seeds and things that we're talking about now that maybe in a couple years will actually see the light of day. You never quite know. But I do think that, there's a kind of a good number of things to kind of have going on. And sometimes that good number is zero because I know that when I finish Star Wars, not knowing what I was going to do next, and I still don't know what I'm going to do. I can't tell you how exciting that is and how good that feels. You know, it's really the first time since I did Felicity that I haven't known on some level, cause I knew I was going Felicity to Alias and Alias to Lost and Mission and then Star Trek. And then, you know, Super 8 and Star Trek Into Darkness and then Star Wars. It's like I've gone from thing to thing to thing, you know, and in the interim done other TV shows and stuff. So it's I'm thrilled now to get to help out however I can. But the truth is that, you know, whatever advice I gave or opinions, you know, and you were open to so many of them. And I'm so grateful. But, you know, you had, and I'm, you know, just for the record, this is so Dan Trachtenberg's movie. This is so his vision, his you know, his debut, his heart and soul is in this totally weird fucking movie that it ends up being, I think, one of the sort of funniest, oddest, scariest, most bizarre genre-bending things I've ever seen. And I could not be prouder to have it be a Bad Robot production. And it's like, it's a total thrill. And so it was really fun for me to get to, like, offer my opinions. And I was always touched when you would, you know, consider them and take them. But we also had a great in-house team of the sound mix is amazing in this movie.
Sounds awesome.
You know, the people who did the sound design on it, you know, Robbie and Lindsay and Will and
Craig,
mixer, Craig.
Yeah, Craig, yeah.
Amazing work. And Bear McCreary does, I think, like one,
oh,
of,
yeah,
the,
Bear McCreary.
One
yeah,
of the great,
great.
Scores.
Walking Dead, yep, too.
But the music he did for this movie is crazy good. Ben Rosenblatt overseeing all the visual effects that we did in-house, all the visual effects and all the mixes we've done at Bad Robot. So I think it was very much like doing a student or independent film. That was the vibe, even though it was a major studio release. And
a first for a lot of people. A lot of those people, it's the first. Yeah. So Robbie got to really throw down the gauntlet on the sound. I got to really throw down the gauntlet on directing it. And Lindsay got to really throw down the gauntlet on producing it.
It's going
to
be one of those movies that in like 15 years, like, oh, they worked on that. And that person worked on, oh, my God.
You know what that is? You know what that is for me? That I've always wanted to tell you, and I was so excited to meet Matt one day and tell him. But The Paul Bear is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I think whenever people say underrated movies, movies never really underrated. It's just a movie that they like and everyone liked, but we just don't talk about it enough. But The Paul Bear, for whatever reason, I think it was its proximity to Friends or something. If that came out today, it would blow people away. It's hilarious and awesome and a really unique movie. But the cool thing about it, it's also it's like Young Sherlock Holmes. Young Sherlock Holmes is written by Chris Columbus, produced by Steven Spielberg, directed by Barry Levinson, and there's probably someone else in that. I don't know.
Matthew Robbins? You know.
Matthew Robbins, probably. But The Paul Bear, produced by J.J., written by Jason Kadams, did Parenthood and Friday Night Lights, amazing, and directed by Matt Reeves. And it's like this origin of these three awesome filmmakers who all went off to do different things.
That's very sweet.
That well, I wish you all the best in the world with it. As I said, I mean, I know – I know because you're on the podcast, I'm sure people expect to go, the movie's really great. But it is really fucking great. And there were genuine moments in the theater where we jumped. And it was just the two of us. Like, even just – I can't imagine what it would be like seeing that with a giant group of people to see a movie like that, to feel the tension in the theater and everything that happens. But you did such a wonderful job.
Thank you. I'm so excited for you, and I'm so excited to see
where this goes. And awesome. And I'm always so delighted by how nice you are to me.
Me?
Just, yes, you.
No, stop.
No. No, you please. Stop it, goddammit.
No, please. You have to – you should just do your podcast out of Bad Robot.
I totally would. I'm excited to – I love the idea that you would be going into another room to talk to Maron, who would be like, so Kylo Ren, he's the hero of the movie? He thinks Kylo's the good guy. Yeah, I really identify with that guy. But you know anything we could ever do for you, anything.
Oh, you're the greatest.
Any
please,
tiny
vice
thing.
Versa. Thank you.
So thank you so
thank
much.
You, sir.
JJ, great to see you.
Great
and
see you.
Dan, thank you.
Yeah,
and again, last chance. If you want to tell us what the Roger Rabbit sequel pitch was like.
No kidding.
I mean, this is
or maybe that's, by the way, that's maybe the next thing.
No, but wait.
Now you don't know your next thing.
Your
full
Roger
circle.
Rabbit sequel.
Wait a
That'll
minute.
Never happen again. There were all those companies would never cross IP streams like that again. Ever.
Wreck-It Ralph, I feel like.
You know, that was the video game industry, which is a little more nascent than than that type of IP. And I think video games, they're all like, oh, we should share all of our characters because it – but getting all of those studios to Disney and Warner Brothers and, you know, and
that
then –
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's
crazy.
It really is nuts.
Yeah, that is true.
So just two lines from the pitch.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I swear to God, it was so long ago. I don't remember. But it never really got past the, like, early stages of What If. But just to talk to Steven about it at all was ridiculously exciting.
Jeez. Well, maybe that's a thing. Anyway, people like Dan and I will talk about
we'll
that.
Wonder
for,
about it. For,
yeah.
What
for
do you think
ages?
It was?
But I do have the storyboard still of the short film that they wanted to do before the movie. I have them. And by the way,
can I have those?
And I gotta find them. I don't usually hold on to stuff.
Wait,
you know?
So you were pitching
that.
The
good,
short?
No,
awesome.
No. What happened was we were talking about the movie, but they had an idea for the short, and I remember going to the animators, and I'd never seen an animation pitch before, and they took you through it performed. You know, and there are these three giant boards, and they would with you know a stick, they'd point to one of the storyboards that were tacked up onto the giant board, and they would perform every frame. And for someone who knows animation, you think, well, yes, that's what they do. But having never seen it before, it was unbelievably entertaining watching these two guys perform this short film. Doing the voices, and it was really
fun. Was it a Roger Rabbit short?
Yes.
Like the beat? Yeah. Okay.
I mean, the thing that always kind of bummed me out about that movie is like you finish, they go, yay, they won. But then you go, well, they didn't because the freeway got built.
Right. Like, in real life.
I live in L.A. and
it
sucks. Yeah, I live in L.A.
Totally.
There is no Toontown.
Red car's gone.
You know, now they're
red car's gone. That's so cool about it. It was about a real thing. Like it was
Chinatown.
Like Chinatown. Yeah, exactly. But I was much more curious about now having seen it later on in life. I'm so much more curious about that story, that conflict than I was about the water thing in Chinatown.
Well, the when Christopher Lloyd was on the
bastard.
Christopher Lloyd was on the podcast.
I guess water is a...
if you get a chance, Christopher Lloyd was on the podcast.
I remember listening to that.
You remember listening to it?
Yeah.
And he goes, it was one of my favorite quotes of the entire run of the podcast. He goes, Judge Doom. fuck.
He's amazing. When,
yeah, he really is.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he really is. But totally. You guys are both amazing. Thanks for being here. 10 Cloverfield Lane is, by the time this comes out, it's out. So people should go see it. Go support good movies. Go support. What are you calling it genre-wise? Are you saying it's
a suspense? If it was in the time of Alfred Hitchcock, he'd be calling it a suspense picture.
It's one of those suspense pictures.
Yeah, it's a mystery suspense thrill ride.
And John Goodman, amazing. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, amazing. And
John Gallagher Jr.
John Gallagher Jr., also fantastic.
Yes, and, totally.
You've done a great job. And,
thank you.
And everyone should go see it. That's it.
Awesome.
Enjoy your burrito,
everyone.
Thanks
for your kind
words. Thank you.
Cheers.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.